You feel victimized by the American dream?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
American dream. We're looking for the American dream. We were told that it was somewhere in this area, but...
The American dream?
Yeah, the American dream.
Tell yourself and go to paradise.
Who doesn't want the American dream?
70% of Americans want the American dream.
America is essentially a dream.
Hold on, you have the American dream. The dream is to be born in a gutter and raised and grow up and get all the money in the world and stick it in your ears and go...
The owners of this country know the truth. It's called the American dream because you have to be asleep to believe it.
Annyeonghaseyo, konnichiwa, hola, and hello. My name is Cliff Hansen, and this is American Dreams. I was going to say that I'm your host, but actually... That's a role I would like you to fulfill. I am your student. I am listening and hopeful that together we can find the American dream if it exists. In many ancient traditions, the teacher had to ask permission before they could educate because it's futile to educate a closed mind, and they had to ask the student if they were ready and willing to hear what they had to say. So I respectfully, give you, dear listener, permission to teach me. To be honest, I've written this introduction for my pilot several times and thrown it away, and I've decided just to improvise because I can't help but continue to think about this missing Malaysian airplane, Flight 370. I think it stays on my mind because it's a weird juxtaposition to be searching for the American dream when so many people are literally searching for the airplane. And I feel, like many people, very powerless as a search combing oceans is underway, and instead I'm sitting in an office cubicle pushing emails around to help someone make money. I know I'm not alone in this feeling, and just wish there was something more I could do. So, for what it's worth, I wish that the families and the crew and passengers of the missing airplane know that... Many of us send out our love and best wishes for them and hope that the outcome of this is positive. Recently, I was fortunate enough to be at the right place at the right time and pull back a child who was about to run in front of the train. It's given me a lot to think about because I know it was just instinct. I never really thought about that moment. It just kind of happened. But it was such a momentous event in my life where... It felt good. It felt like I was accomplishing something great, and it made the rest of my life kind of pale in comparison. I'm not saying that I feel like I need to be putting on tights and a cape and run around town rescuing people, but for that brief moment, I felt like I was doing something like I should with my life. If you look at the news, it's not just this missing airplane. There's a possible war brewing in Ukraine. There's Guantanamo base still open. Our intelligence agencies are literally spending billions of dollars to spy on us naked. It just seems to me like there's a disconnect between what's happening in this world and what should be happening in this world. And I don't know what we can change on the macro level, but I wonder what's possible on the micro level. I wonder what I can change within my own life because I don't feel like I'm living the American dream. I'm jaded. I don't know if it is something that's real, if it's ever existed, or if it was just a marketing ploy to make people live the life that the government or corporations or pastors or parents thought that people should be living. So I've decided to set out and search for the American dream. And as I said, I need your help. This is something that is shared by the American community, whether it exists or not, and... We're going to find it. We need to find it together. So I decided to start up this podcast to ask people in various walks of life what they think the American dream is and how we can find it together. But as an American, my first stop was Google. And I typed in, where is the American dream in Portland, Oregon? Just on the off chance. And surprisingly, it brought up a map. A map to the American Dream pizza restaurant. My heart sank because... It's been my fear that the American Dream is just an advertisement, and this seemed to vindicate that idea, but decided to take it with a grain of salt and a couple grams of Parmesan and some tomatoes as well, and give the American Dream Pizza restaurant a chance, since my buddy Mike from the Peace Corps was coming to visit, and he is a history teacher and a social activist, and he was there at the time in my life where I feel I was the most active in my belief in the American Dream. So if anyone can help me understand our country's past, as well as my personal past, with respect to the American Dream, it's going to be Mike. So we sat down at the American Dream Pizza restaurant for some pizza and had a talk about his feelings about what the American Dream is and if it's something that is attainable. It was a really great discussion, and I hope you enjoy it. Apologies for the really bad audio quality. The pizza restaurant was much more happening than I thought it would be, but I hope you can put up with the bad quality of the background sound for Mike's really good advice. Thanks for letting me sit down with you for a little bit.
Sure, Cliff.
Can I hear a little bit about your background?
I am a middle school, that means for me, 7th and 8th grade, history teacher. I got my start in teaching in the Peace Corps from 2005 to 2008. That's when I fell in love with teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, it's complicated history of travel around the world and two different grad school programs. And I don't use my business major, which was what my undergrad was. But yeah, I love teaching and love getting kids to think critically.
Some of the things you've nailed on are some of the reasons why I wanted to speak with you specifically, partially because of your interest in international affairs, your interest in teaching, and your understanding of the business pragmatics. Yeah, the first question, which is really essentially the name of the podcast, what, for you, is the American Dream?
It's a great question. I would say that the history of the American Dream is complicated. I think it can be used, the concept can be used for something liberating for all people, achieving some sort of a basic standard of happiness in this country. But I think that the history of it is one that it is something that was basically created by wealthy white elite men who were Protestant or deists, and they wanted to kind of entice foreigners to come and work here and bring their capital to our country, and also to inspire people who, such as, like, say, working class or poor European Americans who didn't have that many rights in the early Americas, to work hard so that obviously they'd be benefiting the wealthy by doing that, but maybe they'd be able to get something out of it. That's sort of the background. So when I'm thinking about what it means to me, I'm thinking about these factors. Also thinking about that generally women and people of color were marginalized from this opportunity, this so-called American Dream.
Now, you said concept a couple times.
Sure.
Do you think that it is just a concept, or do you think it is something that is real, actionable, and tangible?
It's an excellent question. I feel that the overwhelming consensus from what I tend to get from the sort of media that I listen to, or the sorts of working class or middle class but underpaid, undervalued professionals that I mix with these days, that it's something that's not achievable for them, or that they feel that they've been left behind in some way.
So you have people in your life now that express that they do not have access to the American Dream?
That they haven't seen it yet. Some of them have given up hope that they can get to that. Some of them are continuing to work harder, and actually usually at the expense of their personal lives, their sanity, their health, towards what appears to me, in my own biased view, because I mean we're all biased in our own ways, but in my own biased view, I see this as, oh, this poor person is just working to no end, and they're not going to really achieve anything to me, but maybe they think that they are, and they're working harder.
I think that's a lot of what I'm trying to get at with this is, so you're noticing that people are working hard, and please correct me if I'm misunderstanding, working hard to reach the American Dream, is that work preventing them from getting it, or would it be inaccessible without that work?
I think that your question is extremely subjective. I think if you talk to some people, they might say that their package deal of what the American Dream is includes some sort of a balance between mental health, physical health, some stress-relieving humor or other things in their lives that produce endorphins, in addition to maybe some sort of status or financial success. But I think to others, I think to every person, they're going to have a different mix.
So you
that
do
makes
feel,
it difficult.
You do feel that there's an individualized, or is there like one American Dream, or do we have a specific, as an American, this is my dream? At this point in the conversation, we were interrupted briefly by Sebastian, the owner of American Dreams Pizza, who had a plate full of food that was way more than either of us could possibly eat. At the risk of turning this into an unpaid advertisement, the pizza was really good, and I would definitely recommend a visit. But anyway, back to our conversation. So we are discussing whether or not there is a shared American dream that we all have the same definition for.
I definitely think that the U.S. government and, you know, whatever, I would say maybe allies it had in the media or you know, sort of like PR tools that they might have had in the media at the time. Think Harper's Weekly, think any sort of like recognized newspaper or something at the time. They might be saying, oh, the American dream is this thing where we're encouraging European Americans to come to America as a place where they can get cheap, potentially free, land, free if Native American genocide is not a concern to you. But basically, if you can care for your land and protect it, then you're good. I think that was the marketing end of it, right? You get cheaper free land, you take care of it and put in that effort, and that land will reap you a source of livelihood and something you can pass down to your descendants. That might be better than the fight between democracy and monarchy going on in Europe.
Do we have that now, though? Because our generation, many of us do not seem to be landowners. We're moving back in with our parents. There's more and more people, which means less and less of them are landowners and more of us are renters. So if that's a component of the American dream, is that something that is no longer applicable?
Well, I think you're right. I think the American dream for a small period of time, when it was more socially acceptable to take Native American land and just use it, it was a real possibility where people who fought off Native Americans who wanted to get their land back or fought off wild bears and did whatever rugged things they did to keep their land and make it profitable for them. Small business owners, which are really the backbone of America, like these Western immigrants, were able to make some things work for themselves. Minus when the Western expansion, when a manifest destiny kind of dream, which is very much linked to this, and you had to have these experiments in the late 1800s of trying to take lands in the Pacific and the Caribbean, you're part of Spanish crown territories and whatnot. That kind of, once that all got settled up, we stopped having free or cheap land. And I think once that happened, the American dream sort of caught up to America, and those promises just can't be fulfilled in a way that works for everybody anymore.
So for you, land ownership and the American dream are pretty tied together.
In my view of it, and from what I think it was marketed to be historically, yes. It later became, hey, industrial revolution coming, immigrants from around the world, especially Europeans, come here and work in our factories, and maybe you too can have this great American dream, playing off the image of the already settled West, which didn't really work for them, because then you get the whole progressive era politics coming up, you get these books coming out in the reform era of like the 1920s, exposing things like sawdust and rat poisoning in canned meats and things like that, like the Swift meat processing factory. So I think those immigrants began to realize they can't really make it work for themselves. Although, I'm not going to lie, there are people who I've met who are descendants of Jewish immigrants or Polish immigrants or Irish immigrants who said, you know what, it was tough, but my grandpa, great-grandpa, did something. He provided for the family, got us a little tiny piece of property, some small amount of money to be inherited, and it does work for some people who would be considered more like lower income or lower middle class or maybe upper working class, but I don't think it works for the vast majority.
If that's part of the American dream, how does someone who does not own land fulfill the American dream?
This is brilliant. Well, I mean, I think this is where you kind of get into the tricky territory that involves issues of like race and class. You know, you're obviously going to have the more working class or poorer Americans in general, regardless of any ethnicity, are going to be saying, I didn't inherit property, so therefore, how am I supposed to pull myself up by the bootstraps, as the saying goes, and make it work? Another thing that goes into that, you look at the lower income areas, which are populated by a majority of white people, because they're actually, if you look at the totality of the working class or poor people in America, the majority is white, because we make up such a huge proportion of the population. But then you also see racial disparities when you look at what percentage of each race is in there. You might have, you know, like three times the percentage of African Americans is in, like, say, a low-income community, you know, or things like that. What I'm trying to say is that I'm including all these factors in. So when we're looking at the class piece, which I've described how the racial composition might be, you have people going to communities and going to schools where all the images they're seeing are of people who their parents are not. You're seeing these rocket scientists, you're seeing these business owners, and they're there with their little families of four, which a poor family might not have two parents in it. It might not have a dad who's a foreman at Ford Motors, not a CEO of a company, or a bank manager or something. So the kids see this, and their self-esteem is sort of like infiltrated at a young age to where it might be more difficult for them to envision themselves in positions of success, because they don't see themselves as represented in that, in the media, in the textbooks, and even their teachers' viewpoints. Because let's not get it wrong, a lot of teachers actually are white women who come from middle income communities and are not the providers of their families, their husbands are. And I encourage the viewers to look up the statistics on the teaching force and see how that you might find that. And so that means that they would be maybe like looking upon their students as a charity study. I'm going to help these poor little kids. As me, a middle-income teacher, I'm going to help you. And, you know, nobody wants to be patronized in that way. Now, despite those things, you're having this self-esteem and this treatment, this influence by the education system on these children's minds. And then you're having the fact that they go home and this is the way finances are. Families have to make tough decisions about their money. Maybe college isn't it. It's you're going to go and work when you're 18 because you need to bring in some money for a household, son. It's not go to college. And it's, did somebody tell you about college, son? Did your teacher tell you about college? Well, let me tell you about college. Do you want to get a loan and be enslaved by the U.S. government for the rest of your life? That's something my dad told me about. You know, he was the first college-going person in his house, but he got it on scholarships because he was lucky. Because the teacher just happened to pull him out and select him. You know, to me, he was saying, if you go to college, which you probably should, you need to find a way that you don't have to take loans. Sure enough, I had to take loans because I tried hard. I really worked really hard to get scholarships, but I could only get so many.
Do you feel, as you said, enslaved?
Being a history teacher, and I try to be sensitive, I think using the word enslaved is sort of a trigger word. You know, I don't want to compare myself to that. But I would say indenture. I would say indenture, because that's within my family's Scottish-American experience, is the whole indenturedness, and I think I kind of do. I'm sort of an indentured loaner. I own money to my credit card company. I own money to three different educational loan organizations.
If I remember right, indentured servitude was, what, 8 years?
5 to 8, yeah.
How long have you been paying your student loans?
Since 2005.
And how long do you think you will?
For another 15 years at least, until I think if the 20-year magic rule works, I get them forgiven after 20 years of payments. So 15 more years, I guess. I don't know. Because my Peace Corps deferment I don't think that counts. So I had to start over after Peace Corps. So,
and yeah. At that point, you'll have paid way more than the loans were worth, right?
Probably a good third more, yeah.
So you've mentioned land ownership and education as two key components to your definition of the American dream.
Absolutely.
I like those ideas because they're both actionable. But I wonder if they are cross-purpose, where without an education, will you be capable of being a landowner? Can you afford that education if you're not a landowner to begin with? Are you able to enter that arena if you don't automatically have either of those abilities from the start?
Okay. Well, first off, I'm a huge proponent of this decentralization of education and having such things as like iTunes University or free programs, because I'm a firm believer that you don't need to pay money to get knowledge. And some of the greatest innovators of our time have been self-taught individuals who were fiercely in opposition to organized education and what it did to their self-esteem and what it did to meet their needs. At the same time, I'm not an idiot. I know that education, especially higher education, is a tool that gets you networks. And some people can get to networks without education. You know the right people in your neighborhood. You know the right people at your church. You know, this is, again, where this might be a little controversial, but for those who don't belong to acceptable faith communities or social support networks, they might be missing out on some context. For example, if say you're an atheist versus a Christian, or let's say you're a Muslim versus a Christian, or let's say you belong to the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, you're going to have a larger network or a smaller network with which you can draw contacts, who can mentor you into how you start your own business, who can provide you with valuable answers to your questions. You know, there's a little cute homework assignments, go interview somebody that you want to be like when you grow up. Well, gee whiz, some people who have a huge church to go to might have a couple CEOs, might have a few managers. There's obviously a bias in that. But at the end of the day, education is about connections to me, which means at tertiary level, which means in high school, middle school, it's about getting the grades to get scholarships to be able to afford a college education so you can make those connections, right? Because you can go ahead and get your online degree, or you can read your books, and you can get all kinds of great information, but without those human contacts, without that networking, I was a human resources major in college, and they said that 75% of getting a job is the contacts that you know. I mean, I hope that helps shed some light on your question.
Yeah, absolutely. So if networking is such an important part about finding employment, mm-hmm. and employment is an important component about having the ability to pursue the American dream,
yeah.
is this something people can be excluded from? Are we saying that if you can't go to college, we are going to remove that many job options from you?
In a nutshell, I think the question that you just asked is true. I think if you don't give people access to a high-level education, you really limit what their job potential will be. I mean, even today, you have groups of CEOs lobbying Congress, such as Bill Gates from Microsoft, saying, we want a new breed, a new generation of working-class Americans that are actually college-educated, at least have a technical degree, they know how to program. They took programming classes in college, they graduate, and they go into making applications for iPhones and Android devices. So you need a specialized form of education, and I think that the industry realizes this, Congress is realizing this, and they're trying to emphasize the math, hard sciences and the math in the current educational movement, and also certain critical thinking and analytical thinking skills in English language arts standards, which is your English classes, right? I mean, the whole country. But I think that's too little too late. And until you start paying people more money for these lower-level jobs, American dreams are not attainable.
There was a really good TED Talk where, and apologies, I can't think of the name of the speaker, but he spoke about how American colleges tend to be places that prepare students to become the next generation of professors in American colleges.
Interesting.
And I think about that, and I had a friend who studied robotics in college and now works selling computer parts at a Best Buy, I believe. And I question how connected those are. He pursued an education in robotics, learned the academic side of it, but then there was not a job waiting for him in that field, and he instead ended up in the service industry. Most of our jobs in America are service industry jobs. Do you feel we are working too much on intellectual pursuits in college when more people might be more interested and more employable if we expanded the trade school option?
Well, this is one of the things where I like to bring in critically a little bit of a Marxist analysis. I know that there was, I'm probably butchering where it comes from, but I remember there was some work that...
You just mentioned Marx. We lost half our audience right there.
Even if you think socialism and communism is a crock BS, you know, like, evaluate some of the stuff just to see, you know, what can be gleaned from it. And there was this whole thing on, like, a manual versus intellectual labor and how there's this weird discrimination between the two where your social status in Western society, meaning society derived from Western European immigrants and sort of like the culture that they kind of created for themselves in America as a dominant culture. And that culture tends to place a lot of stock in positions where you're a manager or an innovator. You're not doing necessarily work with your hands, but you're coming up with ideas and you are managing other people. And that has more social worth placed in it. Whereas people who do the inevitable task to make society function, build the things, construct the things, create the tools, program the computers. I mean, I guess programming, sorry, is probably intellectual, but, you know, that's a gray area with that. Bottom line is that if you're a menial laborer, a manual laborer, what they call technically the working class in America, you're considered somehow inferior, like you didn't work hard enough. But at the same time, you really need these jobs, and I think if we did market in a favorable way and make people feel good about themselves, if they were to take jobs in sort of like go to technical school and get, you know, a job in electronics or sort of like, kind of like the hands-on innovative things, which we really need help with, because that's the future for everything, for finding alternative sources, diversified sources of energy, so that we don't overdo any one, but we use all of them in a smart way that's within the sustainability of our world. You need to be funding these kind of programs and making people feel good about themselves by doing it, not demonizing them.
That actually, you mentioned sustainability, and that took me into one of my major questions.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, we're leaving this next generation with poisonous food, with toxic air, unpredictable weather, government run by the highest bidder. Are our struggles to attain the American dream harder than the generation before us? And are we leaving the next generation with a search that's harder than what we have?
Well, I think it's a really good question. I think it's... I've had a lifelong struggle with my innate sense of optimism. I've always been really idealistic and optimistic. And anytime anybody ever expressed any sort of like, oh, that can't happen, I was always like, I beg to defer. You know, it's been my whole view in life. At the same time, the more I've learned about it, the more pessimistic and more realist I've become. But I feel that as a realist, I have a healthy balance of optimism and pessimism. And I think that we've done some permanent damage to our ecosystem, to what American society could ever become. You know, we've had to take a beautiful document that was written so beautifully for nefarious purposes, but that people struggling throughout our history have managed to turn and make it work and continue every day to try to make it work for them. And I'm speaking of the Constitution, to try to make it work for them every day. There's always like new ideas, like, here's how I can make the Constitution work for us better. It was never really meant to work for many Americans, only a few elite white Protestant men, but it can make it work. I still think that the fact that we are a representative democracy, although I think we have so many characteristics where we basically run as a plutocracy, I think there are the legal frameworks that can be salvaged. I think we, internationally, we have things like the United Nations, things, other economic and political organizations of states in different continents around the world, that we can all work together on a macro scale and in various micro scales. And let's not leave out your local government, your city hall, your city council. Get to know these people and talk to them and let them know how you feel and pressure them that we can really do some great things. But it's going to take a lot of people really being well educated about what are the issues, using their brains for something other than cracking walnuts with, you know, thinking a little critically, not being afraid to realize that you should be humble. You're probably an ignorant fool that knows far less than you really know, but that you should speak up about what you do know and at least debate things. And I think I'm sort of going off topic.
Can you take it back?
Yeah.
You mentioned nefarious purposes behind the Constitution. Do you feel that from the beginning, this country had stacked the deck against some people pursuing their right for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness?
Sure, which meant pursuit of property. I mean, that's what it was legally defined as in Supreme Court cases afterward. I feel that inherently, from the very start, I mean, the country was founded by men who were, a lot of them actually owed money to the British Crown because they were smugglers of Dutch tea, because they didn't want to deal with the high prices on British tea. So they smuggled Dutch tea and sold it cheaper and therefore could make more money. And that made them a huge load of criminals in the eyes of the British, which meant that if they didn't break away, a lot of them were going to be hanged. So they kind of had to make this awesome haven that could attract maybe some middle-class people who weren't in the same situation as them to want to live in these countries and support the cause of being against the loyalists, of being against the British. And I think when they constructed the country, to be as fair and even-handed as they can, I think they're just in their own heads. What is going to work for us and serve our interests? They didn't necessarily mean, how are we going to screw Native Americans? How are we going to screw African Americans? How are we going to screw everybody else? It's, how can we just get the best piece of life possibly for us? And this fact that they ignored everybody else, and they were just tools in their ends of profitability, and their version of a good life, is, you know, what ended up with what we got.
It's House of Cards.
Yeah, it's a good show, and I think so. I'm a firm believer that any true politician, any career politician, I'm probably biased in this way, and I'll admit it, but I say anybody who chooses to become a politician, other than maybe a local level, has to have some sort of, what's in it for you? It makes me want to ask them, like, what are you going to get? I don't trust them.
Do you think they are a lost cause? These politicians, career politicians, that their whole point is politics, not necessarily what the politics are supposed to represent, is using career politicians harmful to us?
Yes. I do think that having career politicians is harmful to us. And having something more like in Plato's The Republic, he talks about how the philosopher king would be the best king because he would be the person least likely to want to be the king. And I think that there is some wisdom in that. Not just to say that all Eurocentric knowledge is great. I'm sure there's these kind of concepts probably come from every culture's mythologies and great thinkings, whether they're written or verbal. But, you know, if somebody, you have to kind of nudge them to be the leader in this situation, they're probably going to be a good leader because it means that everybody agrees that this person has some set of skills that would benefit us in this particular situation or making all decisions, whatever your society is set up to do. And I think it's helpful. At the same time, when you're saying, are career politicians a lost cause? When you started to say that, I started to interpret the question as if you were saying, should we give up on electing certain politicians? And although I am far left politically, I would say that it's really important to work with what you have until you as the people come up with something different. Because I don't believe that this magical little socialist revolution is ever going to happen, where you're going to have a bunch of people who are going to convince people that they need to take up arms and overthrow the government. What's most likely going to happen is people over time, enough of them, if properly educated, will choose that we really need to support something that's a little bit different, or maybe very different, and we need to truly and peacefully convince people of this so we can make it happen. And that's where I think our future lies. But until that happens, I think small piecemeal changes are very important to work within your local politicians and what they do. At the same time, when it comes to my personal voting, I don't vote for Democrats or Republicans. Why? Because even though I agree with people saying you're probably going to lose that vote, maybe the people who are more sinister in terms of their policies are now going to get elected. But I can pat myself on the shoulder and say, at least I worked hard to know that one day, if a third party is elected into the presidency of the United States, that people actually believed that by throwing away their vote, as they say, you could eventually get to that point. And it's not going to happen until we do. That's kind of where I sit with that issue. Pressure the local politicians and dream big. Let's do both.
Do you think we will have any luck in the pursuit of a 28th Amendment to remove corporate money from politics?
I was really excited when Sang started raising awareness for that and the Wolfpack's awareness for that. Because I think it's really important. You know, to be honest, at first, I was skeptical at first. I was still coming from the perspective of, you know, it's all about large systematic change and it's got to be sort of like a socialist-style revolution. And I'm like, I sort of wisened up and I said, you know what, this is an important part of getting to a point where we can have some sort of a larger overhaul of the system to make it fair for everyone. Everyone, even these people who people like to demonize as like the wealthy CEOs, they don't all deserve to just like go and die. They deserve to have a chance to be a human being, which means to live on a more equitable scale of people. We don't need to be paid the same, but there needs to be some boundaries and there needs to be some mutual respect for everybody and what they do, and that we all need to do valuable work for each other's benefit in a society. So getting back to the thing, now that Senator Al Franken is supporting that, it's a little hopeful. Makes me wonder, what might he gain politically from this? Because, you know, he's a senator, right? Senator is sort of like, they're the Senate of the House of Lords from England. So it's sort of like, that's where we got that whole idea, whereas the House of Commons is what became our state assemblies and our House of Representatives. But I feel that the fact that he's behind that, the fact that he's a comedian, a celebrity, sort of will bring some important mass movement to this, and I think it could only result in something positive. But at the same time, I say, any of the listeners out there who support that, make sure you're holding him accountable for what is your vision of that, so that when he supports it, he doesn't just take two talking points from that and say, let's do it. He looks at the entirety of what was proposed, and he's held accountable to that. I think it's up to us. As an aside, because I'm a California teacher, I took my kids to a field trip in Sacramento, California's capital, went to the state assembly. A tour guide who was an ex-Marine said, you know what? He said, no matter what you are politically or what you believe, the thing that's saddest about America today, and this is coming from an ex-military man who, I believe in our country's military, and I still believe, you know, that we do good things, but I've had some looking, when I got my PhD in history, he said, I got some real nasty looks at some California's negative history, what we did to Native Americans, how our laws, you know, don't help a lot of people sometimes. And he's saying that people who don't have an active political awareness in local issues, state issues, federal issues, really don't have the right to complain because they don't really pay attention. And if you don't really pay attention, then what are you complaining about? Do you really know what you're complaining about? I think that's important.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we wrap up, I was just wondering, do you feel you are leading the American dream?
I mentioned the complex mix of factors before. And to me, the complex mix of factors is I have to look at myself in the mirror every morning and know that I'm not hurting the world. And as an educator, working within an educational system that I feel is pretty corrupt, it's sometimes harder to know that I'm actively participating in harming my special education children by denying them the right to take real tests, and then they will never get a real high school equivalency degree, and I'll know that I didn't have enough individualized time to sit with them for hours after school and work with them to get them to grade level standards and everything. But at the same time, I look at myself and I say, I can achieve a lot of good through teaching. Other things besides my career, it's coming to terms with the fact that I'm not going to be able to make a whole lot of money. You know, I make a lot less than even regular teachers make in California because I work for a charter school that doesn't have a union, that the parents set our salaries, and they don't regard us as very deserving of high pay. And that's okay, but I don't see myself owning the American dream in a few senses. I'm not going to have kids, so I'm not going to leave behind my last name as a legacy, which is probably good because I won't be leaving behind any property, most likely, unless something magical happens here. And sorry to say magical. I hate magical thinking. What I mean is, unless I win the lottery or something wonderful happens in terms of financial wealth, some windfall from some random relative that I don't know. I'm not going to be rich. I'm not going to have a lot of property. I'm not going to have an heir, so to speak, you know, a little son or daughter, whatever. But I'm going to be able to work hard to find ways that I can travel cheaply in the world and learn from my traveling experiences. I'm in a profession that gives me some time off. Though I don't have a lot of money, if I cobble together some side jobs, I can save up and find a way to travel or lead a student trip and go see another country and learn from it. And these are things that make me happy. And to me, that's the American dream. I feel very happy. I will die knowing that I was an educator and I was able to do some good in that. And I was able to see parts of the world, and that makes me happy, you know?
Very well. I thank you for your time. You've been very insightful. Thank you for helping me on my quest for the American dream. And I wish you the best of success in yours.
Thank you, Cliff.
Now we can let you get back to your pizza, because mine is gone and yours is untouched.
So there you have it, my first discussion in the search for the American dream. Mike brought up a lot of information, topics about education, land ownership, political organizing. There's a lot there, and each topic is probably going to require its own line of thought. I'd like to thank Mike for sitting down with me. American Dreams Pizza for keeping us stuffed while we had that conversation, you for listening, and hopefully engaging in future conversations with us directly. And again, I would like to send out my best wishes to everyone involved in the search for the missing airplane. For American Dreams, this is Cliff Hansen.
What happens to America's middle class when each succeeding group of young people is carrying more and more debt as they start their adult lives? Can we just talk about that for a minute?